and malicious and nasty and harsh. They may be all of those things, but that isn't what's actually contained within the definition of an asura, asuric mentality. Asuric mentality means that they have an issue, they have a dislike or a disregard for Krishna. That's the key point. They don't like Krishna. Now, I found myself thinking about this morning when I was preparing for this class, and I was thinking that, well, you know, there was time not so long ago when I didn't like Krishna either. I didn't even know who Krishna was, but if somebody told me who he was, I would have argued with them and told them that actually I don't believe that. So I asked myself, is that an asuric mentality? And I had to admit, yes. So there's something within us that may be still asuric, still demonic, still not convinced that Krishna is the supreme Godhead. We may still think, well, you know, this is a Hindu religion, or a Hindu person from a Hindu-Indian origin may think, well, you know, I grew up believing that there was Shiva and there were so many other devas and Krishna's there as well. So, you know, Krishna, why only Krishna? So this is a very interesting doubt. Because whilst we have this doubt, why only Krishna? We're still suffering from this asuric mentality. And we might say, well, no, I'm a nice person. You know, I've done lots of punya, I worship this and that, I did all the good things like Rukmini said. Even if I've done all these good things, and she gave a long list of good things you can do. From deva, worshipping devas and sacrifices and yajnas and giving in charity, she said, whatever I have done good, anything in my previous lives, can you please take it, pack it all up, and put it on the other side of the scale to getting Krishna. I just want Krishna. So she, of course, we can say this is Alila, and so she's absolutely transcendentally situated. So she's like that, but I'm like this. What can I do? And the answer is, you can do a lot, and you have to do a lot. Because we should try in this life to come from this asuric mentality to the platform of deep, deep loving devotion to Krishna. And this is the example that Rukmini shows. And she said, if by chance you can't accept me as I am right now, because I have so many obstacles there, then I'm prepared to take as many births, millions of births if necessary, of penance and austerity just to have you as my husband. And we heard this morning that Srila Prabhupada explained that we all have a television. We all like the television, but we have a television within our heart, but it's broken. It needs to be repaired. And the repair man is the transcendentalist who actually loves Krishna. He can ignite in us the desire also to get to know this intimate friend who is residing within us, who continues to reside within us wherever we go, whatever we do, and we continue to have our back to him. What kind of a friend, therefore, are we? He's a true friend, and we're hardly a friend at all. So this is the mentality that a devotee has to understand. And this, therefore, when we say, I need protection, because the next section of our lila is about particularly Krishna's protection, his reciprocation of his meaning. So we also need protection. We need protection from without, but more, we need protection from within ourselves, from these thoughts and these doubts and these fears and so on and so forth. So let's hear what happens with the dream. And Srila Prabhupada, one time he was speaking about Prahlad Maharaj, and he was saying how Prahlad Maharaj took the opportunity to preach, to speak about Krishna fearlessly. So just imagine having no fear. Maybe we don't think in terms of ourselves having no fear in our relationship with Krishna, but we all have fear and worry about our children, or our health, or our financial status in life. All these things cause us fear and worry. I think every one of us can gently and quietly and privately have a look at your life and see how many areas of your life there's a certain degree of fear and worry. And if there's no fear and worry, it usually means that you're not very intelligent. One time I read a statement that said that if many people are worried about some situation and one person's not worried, it usually means that they don't know about it. And if they knew about it, they also perhaps would be worried. So you look and you see how many areas we have private or public fears. And imagine if they were removed, that there was no fear. We even can't imagine it because we're so possessed by fear. We're so motivated by fear. We're so much busy because of fear. But without fear, practically speaking, most people, they would get inert because that's what drives them. But for a devotee, when the fear is removed, then the bhakti can come up. And so we need Krishna's blessings, his mercy, to remove this impetus of fear, self-preservation. This is the main driving force. Four material principles, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, or fearing. And Srila Prabhupada said, which is the strongest? And very, very strongly, it is fear. We can adjust the others, but we cannot get rid of this life of fear. So Prabhupada is speaking about Prahlad Maharaj, and he says that that teacher was forbidden. He was secular. His teacher was secular. We all live in the secular world. And his father was an enemy. So there's an interesting combination. It goes from nothing to everything against you. All forces against you. Kill you if necessary. Still he was taking some opportunity. As soon as the teacher is out, he'd say, my dear friends, come on, I shall speak to you Hare Krishna and the science. So this should be your policy. Prabhupada starts with our and then he says your because it's already his policy. It should be our policy. So this should be your policy. Whenever there is some chance, just preach this. Whenever there is chance. But we should always know that you will find enemies. So this sometimes stops us from speaking because we know, oh, people, they won't like it if we tell them this. Our family won't like it. Our business people that we know won't like it. Our student fellowship won't like it. And Prabhupada says, but do not be afraid. Go on with your work. So we lose our fear when we see that he has no fear. It's like if I say to you all, don't be afraid, but I'm frightened. And then after some time you begin to notice, oh, she's a little frightened. Maybe I should be a little frightened. But if you meet somebody who can tell you there is nothing to be afraid of, then there's a chance that we can actually start to mold our thinking in such a way that our fear will be gradually reduced and reduced and reduced. Once in Los Angeles, there was a young boy. Actually, one elderly lady became a devotee, and she had two sons. Their names were Veerabhadra and Girish. Have you ever heard of them? Long time ago, in the 60s. So Veerabhadra was about 10, maybe, and Girish was about 5. And they moved into the Los Angeles temple. And every now and again, when you're going through the folio, you'll find, or if you're listening to the tapes of Srila Prabhupada's lecture, you'll find Srila Prabhupada talking to this young boy. And it's quite astonishing, because this young boy is so mature, but he still has the voice of a young boy. So I found this quote and I looked back and forward at the whole lecture to get an idea of it. So Virabhadra says, or Tamal Krishnaraj, I think, was encouraging him. He says, I have four questions. I don't know if they're very good questions or not, but I just wanted to ask them. And Srila Prabhupada says, go ahead. And so the first question, I can't remember exactly, but he was saying about how you say that people who are collecting money and everything, they're miserly. Are you a miser?
Yeah.
And Prabhupada answers him in a gentle way. And then he asks a second question. The second question, I think, was about Prabhupada being sick and what it was like. No, the third question is about Prabhupada being sick. The second question is also something simple and practical that he asks and Prabhupada answers it. The third question, he says, my third question is, when you had that heart attack, did you feel the pain? So only a child can ask like this, right? Because a child is innocent, so they can say anything. And you talk to them in a very open way, because they're so innocent. An adult, you might think, oh, this is not quite an appropriate question, or a very good question, or something like that. But a child, you just respond in a very sweet way. So Prabhupada says, yes. And Virabhadra says, you felt the pain? And Prabhupada says, yes, why shall I not? And Virabhadra says, well, because you're a pure devotee. I mean, you're pure, so you don't feel pain. And Prabhupada says, huh? And Virabhadra says, I thought you said in Bhagavad Gita, a pure devotee wouldn't feel pain because he's always chanting and Krishna is always protecting him. And Prabhupada says, in a very light way, actually, because he's talking to a child, he says, yes, pain was there, but it was not too much. The boys, the disciples, they were chanting, and I was chanting. So there was not so much. It was not so much painful. That I have already explained. When there is distress, so this is a formula that you all must learn if you don't want to be asuras. When there is distress, the devotee takes it like this. I am suffering for my past deeds, but I should have died at this moment. And Krishna is giving me a little pain. That's all. Actually, Prabhupada says, that was the thing. That day, I should have, and now he speaks the truth, because he's speaking to a child, he's making it simple. He says, that heart attack was very severe. Because if you read in the Lilamrita about Srila Prabhupada's heart attack, it was very severe. It threw him backwards, the heart attack. And then he had to go into hospital, and then it was so long time of recovery. So Srila Prabhupada is dismissing it. He's not dismissing it just because he's stoic or he has a high threshold to pain. He's dismissing it because of the mentality he's developed that actually this is Krishna's mercy, I deserve much worse than this. He's strong and fixed in that. The heart attack was very severe. I should have died. Nobody survives such a heart attack. But Krishna saved me. That is all. So here is a very interesting... And then Virabhadra says, after this, he says, are you in this world? I mean, are you... And Prabhupada says, I'm not in this world, yes. And Virabhadra says, you're not in this world. And Prabhupada says, no. And then somebody speaks up on Srila Prabhupada's behalf and says, I thought I heard it said that you are in this world, but you're not with it. You're not part of this world. You are in the world without being a part of it, without being like the lotus flower that floats on the water. And then Srila Prabhupada takes this example and says, yes, yes, in this way, I'm not of this world. So this is what we have to become. We have to live in this world. We have to go to work. Many people have to go to work outside. You can fortify your spiritual environment at home as best you can. And then in everybody's life, young will face it and old have already faced it, there are difficult times. There's times where you feel that you're losing everything. And there are times like cycles. It goes up very high and you feel so happy and everything's so good, and then down and up and down. This goes on in the life of any human being. So in these times, we have to learn to take shelter of Krishna, and He protects. Now let's hear a little bit about this story we're doing this pastime. So Sukadeva Goswami said that Lord Madhusudan also understood the exact lunar time for Rukmini's wedding, and therefore he called his driver, "Daruka, ready my chariot immediately." King Bhishmaka, the master of Kundina, that's Rukmini's father, had succumbed to the sway of affection for his son, and he was about to give his daughter to Sisupal. And the king, although he didn't have his full heart in it, he was getting ready the city of Kundina. They were spraying all of the roads. The elephants would spray fragrant rose water on the roads, and there were flags, and everything was ready for a big marriage. 2 days only. In accordance with prescribed rituals, the king worshipped his forefathers and the demigods and the Brahmins and fed them all very properly. Then he had traditional mantras chanted for the well-being of the bride, because the Atharva Veda mantras, they pacify any unfavorable planets. So all these mantras are being chanted, everything's very nice, like a Vedic wedding, but of course far more grand than a Vedic wedding of today. And then Damagosh, the lord of Chedi, king of Chedi, he had also engaged Brahmin experts in chanting mantras to perform all the rituals necessary to assure for his son's prosperity. He's coming. He's staying nearby. The king has built so many houses for all the guests, royal kings and so forth, and they're staying there. And the king of Chedi is making sure everything's very nice for Sisupal. He's chanting all the mantras, doing all the rituals before the marriage. But it's interesting to note that he's also brought many, many soldiers that are all there as well. So it's not a simple affair. And Jarasandha has come. And Jarasandha, he's extremely powerful. He's called Magdishwar because he is in charge of the kingdom of Magda. And this is basically Bihar and Bengal, that particular area. And he had a very fortified city there. And he was extremely powerful. And he was belligerent to the Yadu dynasty. And factually, 17 times he collected men, and he came all the way from his place to Mathura, and surrounded Mathura, which was a big city at that time, and tried to attack the city, and Krishna defeated him and routed his attempt and killed all his soldiers and sent him insignificantly back. Go away. And then he came back and did it again and did it again. Until the 18th time, when Krishna saw him coming, and he had already built the Dwarka fort, and in the evening he transferred all the residents of Mathura over to Dwarka. So they woke up in the morning in Dwarka. Just imagine, beautiful buildings, all illuminated with jewels, no electricity required, no big pylons and wires and everything. Everything exquisitely beautiful. Gold and marble and precious jewels. And their furniture was made of gold, gold chairs, ivory, this. Everything was so wonderful. And there they were, and Krishna went back to Mathura. And Jarasandha came, and Krishna ran away. Now, Jarasandha didn't defeat him, please note. Krishna ran, and Jarasandha said, "Just see, he's a coward." Now think about that for a minute. 17 times he defeated you. He runs away, he's a coward. So this is the mentality of a materialist. No matter what God does, no matter what good fortune comes, they see some fault in it. So he said, "Just see, he's such a coward." So he chased them and Krishna and Balaram ran to a hill, a mountain actually, and they went up the mountain, and Jarasandha thought, now I've caught them. And he set fires all the way around the base of that mountain. And Krishna and Balaram, because he's inconceivable, unlimited, he's unlimitedly strong, unlimitedly beautiful, unlimitedly everything. Krishna and Balaram effortlessly jumped from the top of the mountain and landed on the ground, and they went straight to Dwarka. And it was soon after that that Rukmini's message came. So Jarasandha was very pleased with himself because he had finished off Krishna, he defeated him as far as he knew. So he came, and he also had his soldiers and armies, and everybody, all the friends of Sisipal, brought soldiers. So it was clear that there was some threat, some feeling that Krishna, they knew Krishna was supposed to marry her, and they were all ready to say, if he comes, we will completely trash him. We will kill him and destroy all his armies and so on and so forth. So they were all waiting there. When Lord Balaram, because we heard this morning that Krishna left suddenly, quickly, it was an emergency. So he left quickly with Dwarka, his driver, and the Brahmana who had brought the message. And so he didn't actually bring any troops. So when Lord Balaram heard what had happened, that Krishna had gone, he was very angry at Krishna. Because he's the older brother, and he would never, out of his love, out of the love of a brother, he would never let Krishna be in a situation of danger. And Krishna, he felt, had done something foolish without consulting him. So he gathered the Yadava troops and he set off immediately for Kundina. Meanwhile, Princess Rukmini is in the palace, in the inner sanctum of the palace, and she's wondering what's happening. And they arrived very, very late or early in the morning, and the Brahmana didn't immediately come to see Rukmini. He waited until the sun came up. So Rukmini was sitting there and she was thinking, and she thought, alas, my wedding is to take place when the night ends. Because the ceremony of going to the temple was then to take place, so it was already started. How unlucky I am. Lotus-eyed Krishna does not come. I don't know why. And even the Brahmin messenger that I sent, he didn't return. And then, just like any of us, when you're in anxiety, she started going over all the reasons why this could happen. You know, maybe I did something wrong in my former life. Or maybe Krishna he rejected my letter. Or maybe the Brahmana didn't make it there. Or maybe the goddess Girija is angry with me because I didn't do her puja properly. Maybe Lord Shiva is having this, he's giving some trouble. Maybe. And then she became so worried, she just closed her eyes and tears were coming down from her eyes and she just didn't want to look at anything. And she kept herself very firmly, her focus on Krishna within, and just sat there thinking, maybe the time hasn't finished yet before Krishna will come. And then she felt some trembling on the left side of her eye and the left side of her face, which is an auspicious sign. And when she felt that, she opened her eyes and there was the Brahmana. And the Brahmana assured her that Krishna had come and he was definitely going to save her and she should not worry about anything. So initially Rukmini became very excited and exhilarated. And then she became very, very controlled. She knew, now I have to act very, very carefully. So then Princess Vaidavi, she wanted to give something to the Brahmana. He'd done this wonderful, kindly act for her. And she thought of whatever she had, what could she give him, and she couldn't think of anything that was in reciprocation for what he had given her. And so all she could think to do was to offer her obeisances like this and bow her head to him. Now, I remember when I first read this long, long ago, I thought, that's not a very nice gift. At least she could have given him 1,000,000 cows or something. All she did was go like this. That's kind of getting out of it. But actually, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that when that Brahmana came home that night, he found that his whole house was full of all opulences, so much wealth, so much of everything. Because Rukmini's glance, she's the goddess of fortune. So when one gets the merciful glance of the goddess of fortune, then one gets fortune. So the Brahmana, he went, and Rukmini got herself ready, and the city's residents now had noticed that Krishna had arrived. And the king noticed that Krishna had arrived, and Krishna came in looking like he was a guest. He'd just come for the wedding, wanted to see, he was going to be a very nice wedding. And the king immediately, he treated him like a guest. He made a place for him to stay, and he worshipped him in the way he was worshipping all the other guests. And inside, he couldn't express his feelings, but inside, he was thinking, oh. But he didn't say anything. He did all the appropriate things for a guest at the wedding, and Krishna came. But all the residents of Kundina, they were looking at Krishna, and they were very open. They were thinking, our princess has to marry him. He's so exquisite. He's so handsome. He's so heroic. Just look at him. He's so charming. And our Rukmini is so beautiful. They'd make a perfect match. And so some of the citizens were saying that Krishna definitely should marry Rukmini. And some of the citizens were saying that Rukmini should definitely marry Krishna. And some of them were saying that Rukmini should marry Krishna only and nobody else. And some of them were saying that Krishna should marry only Rukmini and nobody else. And some of them were saying Krishna must marry Rukmini. And in this way they were speaking amongst themselves. And then the procession began. Now this was a very wonderful festival. Because everybody was all coming out of the palace, and there were so many elderly Brahmin ladies, and then all the courtesans were there, and Rukmini was in a palanquin, and all the guards were there, and the state ministers were on horses, and everybody was all lining up for this long procession. And so many ladies, I've seen the very abbreviated version of this in different places in India. But this was a massive ceremony, and they were all going together, all had their heads covered, and grains in their hands, and jewelry, and cloth, and so many things to offer to the demigoddess Girija. And they were all going together. Rukmini silently went out on foot to see the lotus feet of the Didi Bhavani. Accompanied by her mothers and girlfriends and protected by the king's valiant soldiers who held their upraised swords at the ready, she simply absorbed her mind in the lotus feet of Krishna. And all the while, mridangas and conch shells and panavas and horns and other instruments were resounding, and there was a wonderful auspicious sound. And behind the bride followed thousands of prominent courtesans bearing various offerings and presents, along with well-adorned brahmanas' wives singing and reciting prayers and bearing gifts of garlands. And they had scents and clothing and jewelry. There were also professional singers and musicians and chroniclers and heralds, all glorifying Princess Rukmini and King Bhishmaka and probably the other king, Sisupala, as well, doing so much, just reciting and reciting their qualities. And Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that from her own quarters up to the temple of Bhavani, Rukmini went in a palanquin, and thus she was easily protected. But when she got the last 10 or 15 feet from the temple, she came out of the palanquin and she was walking herself. She went on foot, and the royal bodyguards were stationed outside the temple on all sides. The elderly Brahmini ladies, expert in knowledge of rituals, led young Rukmini in offering respects to Bhavani, who appeared with her consort, Lord Bhava. So here, these ladies They knew what Rukmini wanted. So just like the gopis worshipped Katyayani, but they worship Katyayani only because they want Krishna. So they're prepared to do anything, even worship a demigoddess. It doesn't matter who it is. They have to have Krishna. They're intent on having Krishna, and whatever it takes to get Krishna, they want to do that. So similarly, the Brahmin ladies, Rukmini offered so many presents, and they taught her the mantras to say, please, 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 make Krishna my husband and nobody else. And then the demigoddess gave them all a feeling that it shall be so. Now then, Rukmini, she was about to actually leave the temple. And so there's a beautiful description of her here in the Bhagavatam. Rukmini appeared as enchanting as the Lord's illusory potency, who enchants even the sober and grave, like Mohini Murti. She just bewildered everyone, even Lord Shiva, who is so, so dira, so grave and sober. Everyone became just totally melted by her beauty, because this is Krishna himself, or Krishna's potency. He's all beautiful. There's no way you can resist him if he wants to show you his beauty. So she is in the embodiment of Krishna's beauty potency, his internal potency, and the king gazed upon her beauty, her beautiful waist, her lovely face, beautiful face adorned with earrings, and her hips were very beautiful with jewel-studded belts. And she was so charming, and her eyes looked like as if her eyes were shy of the approach of her hair. That means that her eyes were very wide, and her hair was very curly, and so her hair and her eyelashes were very close to each other. This is also a sign of great beauty. She smiled very sweetly, and her beautiful teeth reflected the glow of her red, bimba-like lips. As she walked with the motions of a royal swan, the effulgence of her tinkling ankle bells beautified her feet. Beautiful golden, jewel-engraved ankle bells tinkling, tinkling, tinkling. And all these powerful kings, they're looking at this. And they're looking at this, and this is going to absolutely astonish them. Seeing her, the assembled heroes were totally bewildered. Lust tore at their hearts. Indeed, when the king saw her broad smile and her shy glance from the corner of her eyes, they actually fainted. They dropped their weapons and fell off their elephants, because they're all sitting up big and looking very proud. And they were all thinking, she shouldn't marry Sisyphos, she should marry me. I'm the only person who's good enough for her. So Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur tells us something wonderful. He says that at that moment, Rukmini manifests two forms. One form was the external energy, which was seen by the asuric persons who cannot actually appreciate Krishna. Why should Krishna be God? Why does he own everything? Why can't I have this thing at least? This is mine at least. That's not his, it's mine. Asuric mentality. Then you see everything in a mundane way, a material way, for my enjoyment. This is for my enjoyment. So they cannot enjoy the goddess of fortune. So she manifests an external form, and they saw that. And she manifests a form only for Krishna's pleasure, and Krishna saw that. Rukmini displayed her beauty for Krishna alone, and slowly she advanced on her two moving feet, awaiting the arrival of the Lord. So she came out of the temple holding the hand of her girlfriend. She had beautiful jewels that she had given to and received as prasad from the deity. She was very beautifully ornamented. She came out And she moved her hair away a little bit from her eyes so she could see a little more clearly. And she looked at all the kings. And they all went faint. And she wasn't looking at any of them. She was just going, where is Krishna? There is Krishna. When she saw Krishna, she gave him a gentle smile, very shy, gentle smile. And Krishna, he walked forward, took her hand, and she very eagerly hopped onto the chariot. And Srila Prabhupada has told us that she held the reins and drove the chariot because Krishna had to fight with all those who were going to follow and try to get her back. She was a princess. She wasn't some innocent young girl. She was a powerful young lady. So, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, Rukmini was anxious that her locks of hair might impede her vision, since she was most eager to see her beloved Krishna. The non-devotees, or the demons, are bewildered at seeing the opulences of the Lord and think that His potency is meant for their gross pleasure. Now, we should think sometimes when we hear these things, am I a bit like that? A little bit, not too much, I'm pretty nice, but a little bit of that is there. We should see, a little bit, maybe, sometimes, not often, but occasionally. We should allow us to see what is our true interior, because if we see it, we can do something about it. If we don't see it there, when anyone says to you, do you know you've got a bad habit? It's like sometimes with men, their wife says, do you know you snore? And I say, I do not. So, yes, you do. I do not. And then she gets her little, you know, little mobile phone and takes a recording and says, there! And then he has to say, that's for somebody else. So we shouldn't be like that. We should be willing to see. Yes, I have something in me that could do with a little purification. And Krishna should help me with that. And he should protect me from these things, so that I too can give myself fully wholeheartedly to him. Rukmini, as an expansion of Krishna's internal potency, was meant for Krishna alone. So when she was taken very shyly looking at Krishna up onto the chariot and he rode away, all of these soldiers and kings and stuff, but they had fainted. So they were just getting back on their feet when they noticed that she was gone. And Krishna was up higher than them with his chariot with Garuda. So it looked as though Garuda took her. It was very mysterious. Suddenly she wasn't there. And they were all like, what was that all about? And gradually they began to figure out what had happened. So once she had gone, and Balaram comes in with all the soldiers, ready for a fight. If they want to fight Krishna, he's going to fight them. You see, this is Balaram. So Balaram is so important. We have to learn how to take shelter of Balaram. He comes right in there and says, you want to fight? Fight with me. So when we have our demoniac thoughts, we have to say, Balaram, please help me now. So then they started to think to themselves, what is this? What's going on here? And they said then that, what is this? Krishna has just taken her like a jackal takes the booty of a lion. Now remember earlier Rukmini was saying, you are the lion amongst men. You can't have a jackal take what belongs to you. But they, because of their perverse mentality, opposite mentality, saw the totally opposite way. From the last two verses of this chapter, it is clear that the perverted intelligence of demons, asuras, makes them perceive things in a way exactly opposite to reality. Now think about this for a minute. If we have a wee bit of that tendency within us, that will allow us or control us in such a way that we will be seeing things exactly opposite to what they really are. It is clearly stated that Krishna stole Rukmini like a lion taking his prey in the midst of jackals. The demons, however, saw themselves as lions and Krishna as an inferior creature. Without Krishna consciousness, life becomes most dangerous because you're seeing exactly opposite. So how do we develop these eyes? How do we get to the point that we can see things properly? We come back again to the very same point, and that is the hearing, to hear about Krishna, to learn about Krishna, to study, to find out what Krishna is really, who he is, so that we can relieve ourselves of our indifference or even our inimical feelings, our doubts, our fear, and all of the rest. Prabhupada says, the Supreme Lord Krishna cannot be seen by our present conditional vision. In order to see him, the present vision has to be changed. That's what we just heard. It has to be changed. How? By developing a different condition of life, a different way of looking at things, which is full of spontaneous love of Godhead. When Sri Krishna was personally present on the face of the globe, not exactly everyone could see him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as we just heard. Materialists, who were highly qualified personalities by acquisition of material assets, they were unable to see Krishna and appreciate the presence of the Lord. Therefore, even though the Lord may be present before our eyes, it is not possible to see him unless we have got the necessary eyes to see him. This necessary qualification is developed by the process of devotional service only, beginning with hearing about the Lord from the right sources. So have you ever had the experience that you go into the temple room to take darshan of the deities, and you can't see them? You can barely keep your mind attentive enough to figure out what color they're wearing today. Instead you go outside and someone says, what color are they wearing? I think it was blue. But you can't even see them, even though they're present before you. You see exactly opposite them. So this is important to understand, because then we can understand how we need protection. Because once you know I need protection, you will seek it. I put in the search of the Veda base the words, Krishna is protecting. Krishna's protection. And I found some quotes from Srila Prabhupada. Would you like to hear them? People are fond of saying, God helps those who help themselves. But they do not understand that helping yourself means putting yourself under Krishna's protection. Krishna is protecting us at every moment. But we do not realize this because we have taken life at our own risk. How often we see this? If you're out in the world, you see everyone taking their life at their own risk. I think that would be a good thing to do. I don't mind doing that. Let's go do that. That would be fun. I'd like that. Let's do this. Let's do that. Oh, no one minds it. And such a sort of an air in modern society of downplaying anything. Especially you're not supposed to say something's right and wrong. You're supposed to say, anyway, we're all, you know, different people, different strokes for different folks and so many things. You're not supposed to say, it's very politically incorrect to say, actually, when you do that, that's really bad. You'll get a sinful reaction for that. You'd be looked upon very frowningly if you said something like that. So people are taking their life at their own risk. If one is fully surrendered, Krishna takes total charge and gives special protection. So, can we change that? Because we may, none of us feel that we're fully surrendered, and we can say, To the degree that one is fully surrendered, to that degree, Krishna takes charge and gives special protection. We can relativize that statement because we're not on that high level. We don't change the formula itself. We keep the formula, but we put it in such a way that we can relate to it, not being on the highest platform as yet. If you get Krishna, you get everything. Why try for this thing and that thing? Simply try to get Krishna, Krishna's protection. Why agree to die? Because Krishna from within, oh, this is an important one. This was about Parikshit Maharaj when he was cursed by the young Brahmin boy to die. Prabhupada is asking the question, why did he accept that curse? He had the power to reverse that situation. Plus, he had very serious responsibilities. And he was a young man, not an old man. And he was doing welfare work for the whole world. He wasn't just acting selfishly. So why did he just let that go? Why did he not counteract that? And Srila Prabhupada said, why he did not? Because Krishna from within dictated to him, Parikshit, now agree to die. Just imagine how advanced an exalted personality is. Now agree to die. And why? Because if not for that, the Srimad Bhagavatam would not have come. That is the answer. So how surrendered? And if you hear from the Brihat Bhagavatamrita of Sanatana Goswami, he describes how Parikshit Maharaj, we spoke about this in our last retreat, is describing to his mother only moments before he's about to leave this world to be bitten by the snake bird of the curse of the Brahmin boy. He was describing to his mother about the glories of Sri Vrindavan Dham. He was answering her question because she said, please, you've been listening for 1 week to all of this. And I have not been here because she could not be present. So please sum everything up in the essence. Tell me the essence of what you have heard. And so he did. And by Sanatana Goswami's wonderful pen, he has written this wonderful book. And in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, everything, the whole universe, what's everywhere is described. So then, when you've seen everything, if you ask, why did he write that book? Oh, because then you don't have to go everywhere. you can hear about what the whole universe is, what it's like, what you will gain, what you will experience, spiritually speaking, not what the weather is like, and what the houses look like, and how cheap or expensive it is to stay there. But you hear, and then you understand that actually this universe, the whole universe is actually unsuitable for me. And then you'll also hear what it's like beyond the universe, and you start to think, oh, that sounds pretty nice. And then when you start hearing, oh yeah, that's available, then you start thinking, oh, how? And then the eagerness starts to come. And when the eagerness is there, the Krishna consciousness process becomes easy. It's only for lack of that eagerness that it's difficult for us. Our eagerness or our rati or our ruchi is spread over so many things. So many, so a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here. And any one given thing we have about that much. Whereas these personalities have like an ocean in one special place. So this is what we're encouraged to cultivate. And Prabhupada was speaking about who helped him when he came. He said, we care only for Krishna, that is all. This was in 1976 in Vrindavan. Prabhupada said, I didn't care for anyone. I simply cared for Krishna, that's all. And my Guru Maharaj, that's all. I went to your country on the order of my Guru Maharaj, under the shelter of Krishna's protection. That is wanted. Krishna's protection. We want two favors, one from Guru and one from Krishna. So you have to fight. So after we're hearing all these wonderful words, it's not like saying, now sit peacefully and relax. No, you have to do your part. Just like we're hearing about the negative aspects of the material world, and we're here in retreat in a beautiful environment, and then one may, for those who are listening very attentively, you start hearing like, oh, I have to go back and I have to go and do this and that and so on and so forth. And then that's when Bhagavad Gita becomes very relevant. Because remember, when Arjuna surrendered to Krishna, he didn't stop any of his actions. He just changed his consciousness. And everything became quite different as a result. So we don't, when we surrender to Krishna, we don't give up everything. But we give up the mentality that everything is meant for my enjoyment. Anyone who has given sincere service to Krishna for any one day, he cannot go away. He has Krishna's protection. This life, that life, one day, little service to Krishna, immediately, permanent account. It will never go in vain. But we should not for that reason become neglectful. We should not think, as sometimes immature devotees think, oh well, you know, I do a bit of Krishna conscious activity and then I just have a good time because I know, you know, it's accumulating in there and it'll come, you know, and everything's okay. And one time I was talking to somebody about, and you tried to sort of scare them because they were not very sober, and saying, but what about next life? And they said, oh, that's not a problem. I've done so many nice things. I did this and this and this. So I'm sure I'm going to get a human birth. There's no problem about that. So we don't want to be like that. That's not intelligent. That's immature. And immaturity doesn't always bring the result you would expect. We want to become mature. And we want to put more and more in that bank account. Because by doing so, we're very, very, very fortunate now, and we're very fortunate in the future as well. When chanting the Maha Mantra, we are completely safe, even in this most dangerous position. So take care to advance in Krishna consciousness, and your happiness is assured. So these are some wonderful quotes from Srila Prabhupada to encourage us so that we can also seek Krishna's protection. I was thinking when I was preparing this, how, in a way, I was thinking, is it that while we're hearing this, we should be thinking more about being protected from them or that? Or should we be thinking about being protected from this? And I came to the conclusion, of course, it's both. Krishna protects you from the outside, he also protects you from the inside. And then I remembered how the first, when we went to Hong Kong, it was in 1971 that the first Krishna book came out, and then the second Krishna book came out. I think it was also in 1971. And we got copies of them in Hong Kong. We were just newly married, a few months actually. And it was a difficult time. We didn't have any place really permanent to live. We didn't have permanent visa status. So everything we were doing was illegal. And we were living in a guest house room, and in that guest house room we had sort of managed to put all the furniture upright. It was a type of cheap guest house. We put all the furniture and made the room as empty as possible and set up a little tiny altar, and we had to cook in there secretly because you weren't allowed to cook, and we had a kerosene burner and cook in there. And I had to go and wash all the dishes in the bathroom toilet because there was nowhere else to wash them. If I wanted to wash them in the kitchen, I had to move aside piles of chopped meat because Chinese people were rather, these ones were rather meat fond. So I didn't like that, so I would use the bathtub. And of course that wasn't any fun either. And sometimes at one time there was a fire in the guest house and we couldn't even get into the guest house. And all we could do was take our luggage to some friendly Indian family, And they kept our suitcases at their house. They had a small apartment. And we went out looking for somewhere to stay, but we didn't have any money, really, to speak of. So we met one very friendly Indian gentleman, and he wanted to help us. And so he said, I have a guest house. It was just a few rooms, an apartment with a few rooms that he was renting. He said, you can stay in this room here. It's being rented by someone. You can stay at night. You have to be out by 5. And make sure you make all the sheets really neat so they don't know that you were there. They work at night. So you can come in at night, sleep, make it all very nice, and then you leave. So we get up with our chapa beads, make the sheets really nice. This went on for 2 weeks. And then we go to the park. Where else are you going to go? We couldn't even get into the building. And then we found another place to live, because that one wasn't so nice. And it was a very, very fancy guest house. And the rooms were like magnificently wallpapered in this kind of suede wallpaper with beautiful designs on it. And the bed was all frilly and everything. And we thought, this is very nice. And then we started thinking, where are we? Maybe we're not in the right place, because we realized this might not be the kind of guest house we should be in, because we didn't know what was going on in that place. So one night we came back, and I'd been reading particularly the second volume of the Krishna book, and I remember we came back and it was dark and it was raining. I can even remember the street that we were going down. And we got back to that apartment, to our room in that guest house. And we lost the key. We left the key inside. And it was like 10 o'clock at night. And we had to go and find somebody to open it. We had to find a keysmith, you know, late at night. So we had one umbrella and we were walking the streets. And I remember I was in such a bad mood. It was so difficult. Why did it have to be so difficult all the time? And we were walking up and down the street. We found some Chinese, an old Chinese man who came and he opened the door. But I remember very clearly at that time, I was meditating on these pastimes that I had just been reading about Krishna, and I thought, they're amazing. You know, Krishna is so chivalrous, and he's so heroic, and well, very attractive. So I saw for myself that Krishna is capable, personally, he's capable of giving that kind of protection, and Prabhupada is promising us this. So then a question should come into perhaps our minds if we're going to debate with the asura part of our nature, and it will say, I know lots of people who aren't happy even though they're devotees. I know devotees who haven't got what they needed. I know devotees who have suffered. And what about all the people that were killed in wars? And what about all the suffering in the world? And you're telling me that God, he's so giving protection? And then we have to go back again to Shastra and look through the eyes of the Shastra and say, yes, if you want to live your life at your own risk, it's risky, it's dangerous. You don't know what's around the corner. So better to live under Krishna's protection. And if he hasn't given you what you wanted, and instead you've experienced a lot of suffering, then try to adopt the mentality that Srila Prabhupada is speaking about. When he had his life-destroying heart attack. And he thought, Krishna is so kind, I should have died with something like this. For all my sinful activities, I should have suffered so much more. But somehow Krishna has minimized it. We have to learn to think like that if we want to become really serious, very serious devotees. And that's hard work. And that hard work we cannot avoid. If we want to actually affect the lives and hearts of others, we have to first of all make that advancement ourselves. Thank you for listening very patiently and tolerantly. It's very difficult to listen in the afternoon. It's difficult to sit down after lunch, and this isn't the best time of the day for Kirtan, but you've been so patient. So we have a few more minutes, I think, if anyone has any questions. And thank you for having questions this morning. It was very nice. Yes.
Yeah. Just before the class, this thought came across. Our progress depends on our conviction, right? So, how can we develop this firm conviction that, oh, Krishna is protecting us, or Krishna, I mean, if I pray to Him, then I will, you know, do advancement in Krishna consciousness. Or how can we develop that firm conviction in our Guru's word as well? How can we develop this firm?
Well, one way you can do it is by theoretically, you can use, there's theory and practice, and always these two elements. So theoretically, you can do it through shastric study. You can hear what Krishna says, and then, and what your Guru says, and what Srila Prabhupada says, particularly Srila Prabhupada, because he's our founder, Acharya. So everyone and everything, it came from his faith. So when we go to him, he's at the crux. If he's not there, then everything else will be dislocated, will separate. So if you go and read from him, you can see. If you read of his example, you can see what he has done. You can hear from him. You can get to know him like that. You don't only get to know somebody by meeting them physically. In fact, some people get to know somebody so deeply who they've never met, much more deeply than somebody who's met them and thinks, oh yeah, I know them, they're, you know, so and so and so and so. So that's on the theoretical side. Of course, it's not only theoretical. And the other thing is, you have to put yourself in a situation where you can experience it. You have to put yourself forward to make a test and see. Not that you resign your job and nothing that dramatic, but Krishna, if he hears you from within, awakening and asking this question, he sometimes can give you a little hint. Why don't you do such and such? And you think, oh, no. And you think, oh, okay. And you do it and you find that actually that has given me further enlightenment. I'm actually feeling some experience of Krishna's reciprocation. And another way is you should try always when you go to the temple, and Srila Prabhupada told us this, when you go to the temple, bring something for the deities. Always. If you don't have a physical offering, then you make some prayers to them. And stop in front of them and make some special effort as if, I say this, you know, as if they're real. If that was really Krishna there, what should I do? Should I do a really quick obeisances and get out of here as quickly as possible because I want some Mahaprasada? Should I, you know, answer my mobile phone and rush out of the temple quickly because it might be something important? What should I do if that really was Krishna? It's very exciting because all of a sudden you get excited about Krishna consciousness instead of being excited about everything else, and Krishna consciousness is just a routine. You start to think like this, and it's, your Krishna consciousness becomes alive. And it becomes more interesting than anything else. And you did it. And this everyone has to do for themselves in their own way. These are some suggestions anyone can think. How can I increase my sense of feeling that Krishna does take care of me? And what can I give him in exchange? If he's real, what would he like? And then if you do that, and there's reciprocation, then you begin to know, oh, he might be real. Wow. You know what I mean? We'd like to say, you know, of course, the appropriate thing to say in a class is, of course, Krishna is real. But when we're speaking on a level of practice and how we can improve our practice, then we have to look also at the doubts that we might be holding on to, or our misapprehensions, as Prabhupada calls it. And there's one place I heard Srila Prabhupada was saying, he said, you should surrender to Krishna and seek his protection, but you do not believe he exists. So he himself recognized this. So we want to get rid of that mentality somehow. Good question. Yes.
It's a question related to the morning class, can I ask?
Yes.
Like how you were mentioning that in that video show about understanding about Krishna's big plan,
yes,
bring everyone back to him.
Yes.
So will it ever happen that there will be no need in this material world that, you know, eventually everyone goes back to him?
No. No. Because there is an unlimited amount, it's beyond our ability to understand, but there is an unlimited amount of jivas everywhere, like in this room, atom to atom of jivas are here. We only see a few people, but this whole room is occupied by jivas, living entities. They're everywhere, they pervade everything, in the fire, in the water, it's everywhere. And Krishna performs his lila in the material world. So the material world has to remain for two reasons. One reason, because there are always some individuals who think, maybe I would like an alternative to surrendering to Krishna. So Krishna so kindly has provided the material world for that purpose. But much more than that, he's provided the material world because he comes here and he performs beautiful pastimes. He performs them for the benefit of those conditioned souls, those who've turned their back on him with determination. But he also performs them for his own pleasure and for the pleasure of those loving devotees who haven't turned their back on him. And Srila Prabhupada was explaining one time that Krishna goes when he's born in this universe. As soon as the birth occurs, he's born in another universe. He's born in another universe, he's born in another universe, he's born in another universe. And he asked the devotees, he says, so, like seconds, he said, how many seconds in an hour? And they're all calculating, and one of them said, I need a piece of paper. And Prabhupada said, no, just wanted to give them an idea. And he said, there's so many seconds in an hour, seconds in a day, seconds in a year, seconds in 100 years. He said, that's approximately how many universes there are. And I got a piece of paper and started trying to work it all out. And it comes to like in the millions and millions and millions. Millions and millions and millions of universes. And Krishna is there, and then there, and then there, and then there. He's there for all the time, like the sun. His leelas, one after another, are rotating. And so when a living entity decides that actually I want to serve Krishna now, I've had bitter experience here. I haven't become enlightened by my experience here. I feel now the necessity to surrender to Krishna. That fortunate soul enters into the place where Krishna's lila is being performed, a particular lila at that time, and then he proceeds in that way to enter into the pastimes of Krishna in the spiritual world, here in the material world first. And then, when he has become more and more and more perfect, he can go to the eternal realm. And according to Brihadbhagavatamrita, those who are liberated, they go between that place and here. And they don't look at anything else, not interested in anything else. Krishna's lila here, Krishna's lila there, and they see no difference between the two. So for them, the material aspect of the material world has no inconvenience or cause of suffering. They remain permanently with Krishna there and permanently with Krishna here. This is what Srila Prabhupada is speaking about. This is what Shastra is saying. This is what he came to give us. So we should be intelligent enough to take advantage of it. Thank you. Is that okay?
Yeah. One more question?
Yeah.
You, like from today's class, you were quoting Srila Prabhupada, how if we sometimes talk about fear, we're fearful in preaching.
Yes.
And Srila Prabhupada said that you keep going anyway, that you have to say the right thing anyway. Could you elaborate more on that? Like how to
it's not that we should be rude to people. And it's not that we shouldn't be intelligent, like Srila Prabhupada talks about how He gives the example of Prabodhananda Saraswati, who puts a straw between his teeth. This is an indication of extreme humility. And he says to whomever he's speaking, "My dear sir, you are so great. You are so intelligent. You understand so many things. You're so, so, so smart. But please, give it all up and worship Krishna." So some people preach like that. Srila Prabhupada sometimes preached like that, expertly. And sometimes he preached in a very forceful way, where he was very challenging and he would speak to very important people and call them all kinds of names. And they didn't mind because he was so cultured. And there was no anger, personal anger. He was speaking like a representative, you know, like if the representative of the police department comes and tells you, you know, "I'm representing the state and you've done such and such and you're a this." You don't say, "Don't call me that." Yes, yes. And so people would sometimes just, they would melt when Prabhupada called them names. And sometimes they didn't. Sometimes he would speak to people and they were rude to him. And they were very disrespectful, like Jarasandha with Krishna. They couldn't understand who he was and couldn't see what was going on. All these various circumstances were there, but he never stopped. And that's the point. He never stopped. So we shouldn't stop and think, "Oh, this is too hard." We should try and find another way to do it. Something should be there. Something is better than nothing. So we should try to always be offering something. And if you can help somebody else, he explained also that if you help others by giving them Krishna consciousness, even at the risk of so many inconveniences to yourself, you become so intimate to Krishna. He loves you so much for doing that. And he said, and this is our business, to become intimate with Krishna. He was speaking to one group of young devotees and he was saying, "You know, I have to spend gallons of blood on each one of you. Because, you know, we have so many misconceptions and we wander off here and there. You've got to be so patient and so much effort has to go into just turning us a little bit. And at any moment we could zip off anywhere into the universe." And so he was pointing this out, that so much hard work I have done, I am doing. But it is so that Krishna will be pleased. Because if Krishna is pleased, then everything will be wonderful. Any other questions? Yes, please.
Mother, Irukmani was described as goddess of fortune.
Yes.
The goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, can benefit one with opulence. Material opulence.
Yes.
So, in a spiritual sense, material opulence is an obstacle for spiritual progress. As the Kunti is prized, Janmaishwara is the three
beings. Yes. But she says if somebody possesses these things, they can't feel akinchana gocharam. They can't feel that I have nothing. But there are great personalities who have so much material opulence, but they don't think of it as theirs. We hear about these kings. I may not see anyone quite like that at the present moment, and certainly for a beginning devotee, opulence is difficult. It's quite difficult because you think, "I've got everything I need. So why should I... Well, I don't need to say help. You know, I've got this, I've got that, I'm intelligent, I'm good looking, I'm everything." So I don't, this is for weak people, for people who are really poverty stricken. So in that sense, opulence isn't good. But if somebody becomes a very, very serious devotee and they have opulence, that's wonderful. Because they can use it properly in Krishna's service.
If an advanced devotee like Kunti Maharaj can feel that it's not good having all these things, like it always can mislead a normal person or a neophyte,
yes,
to take the benediction of fortune or material opulence,
yes,
which is...
Well, the thing is that I've heard Srila Prabhupada say on numerous occasions that you can't change your destiny at all. And we, struggle with that, especially as Westerners, we really struggle with that because we don't have this kind of cultural understanding. But he explains that from your previous lives, this life is already set up for you when you come into this world. And so a certain amount of opulence will come to you and a certain amount of suffering will come to you. And so if you spend all your time trying to increase your opulence or reduce the difficulties in your life, you'll get nowhere in your Krishna consciousness. So therefore, he directed us away from thinking about these things and trying to think about our Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, we're living in the material world. Sometimes we have to be very practical. We have responsibilities, we have so many things. So that's there as well. So if we're working and we're trying to achieve something in the material world, we then should ask ourselves also, am I thinking that this all belongs to me? If I'm thinking it all belongs to me, I'm going to have a lot of anxiety and a lot of activity that's also not going to be related to my Krishna consciousness. Or am I thinking that actually I can use these things somehow in Krishna's service, these things, I'm a bit attached to them. What to do? That's there. If I buy a new car and somebody smashes into my car, of course I'll feel something. I won't just say, oh, never mind. But it'll be secondary to our primary interest, which is to develop our love for Krishna, because ultimately it's all his. And it's not going to stay with us very long. Lakshmi Devi is chanchan. Do you have any more question on that?
Yes. Okay, because goddess of fortune is there to benedict with affluence. People tend to think for granted, like, okay, she is meant for that, like, instead of worshipping Krishna,
yes.
Worship Lakshmi.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's how it happens.
Yeah. Lakshmi Puja and Durga Puja.
So that type of
The material world is considered like a prison house. So there is lots of different levels of prison cells. There's an A block and a B block and a C block and a D and an E block, and then maybe you have a ladies section, a man's section, maybe there's juvenile delinquents as well. So the material world is a very, very complicated, elaborate arrangement for all those who don't want to serve Krishna, who don't want to accept his supremacy. So all of these things go on, and sometimes we speak about them very, very heavily. And at other times, we can see in those situations Krishna's amazing mercy, that he's giving everybody something that they desire. And he's not angry with them. He travels with them. He wishes to enlighten them. He wishes them to turn to him. And he wishes to remind them that this is not the best thing to do. That's not the best thing to do. Why are you doing this? Just serve me. But he's so patient. So sometimes we have to also learn to be very patient, as well as being very firm. Even with ourselves, we have to learn to become patient, because we've got this time immemorial disease of aversion to Krishna. It's not an easy thing to cure. But after talking about patience, you've got to talk about determination and perseverance, because if you're going to be patient, you have to also be very perseverant, or you get nowhere. Yes. Yes. Two questions at the back.
Isn't the Lakshmi of the materials a different personality to the Lakshmi that's engaged in Krishna's service?
Yes, Lakshmi is the internal potency. But they're also worshipping Durga in the same way, and she is the external potency. They pray to her and, seek her blessings because they know she also can provide. But the Lakshmi who is Rukmini Devi is, she's the internal potency of the Lord. So the devotees don't look at her like that, seeking her blessings in that form. And those that do, they're not actually seeing her, like we heard about the kings who are seeing the opposite thing. They're seeing the material form. Are we hearing that quote? Yeah. But I think that's not totally relevant to what you were saying. I think I may be wrong, because you're expressing concern about devotees seeking any opulence from any, because Kunti Devi is saying, I wish you to take it all away, it's not good. Did I understand you correctly? Yeah. Thank you, Anirudha. Yes.
Well, this is a small clarification on the previous question. How to overcome fear? We can understand theoretically that like Krishna is there for the protection.
Yeah.
But maybe Krishna is giving up protection according to his own time. Like take an example of Rupa Devi.
Yes.
When she was not aware that Krishna is there and she was thinking, oh, maybe this is wrong, maybe this is wrong, maybe this is wrong. So maybe that fear sometimes may affect our faith.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
So how to overcome all this?
Well, that's again a very personal thing. And I find, I'm now not speaking philosophically, but practically, that fear goes so deep into the psyche that it's involuntary, like breathing. Because, you can think like this, we have spent countless lives in the material world, and every one of them, the body that we identify with has been destroyed, and often painfully. And we carry that in our subtle body. We travel on from this life to the next life in our subtle body. And we carry that. And so much so that Madhvacharya one time wrote one quote, which is quoted, I think, in the Bhagavatam, where he says, every living entity has cried an ocean of tears from the stay in the material world. I mean, just think. Every 100 years or less, depending on what kind of body you've got, you're wiped out. And you think the body is you, so you get obliterated. And the next one comes and that gets obliterated. All of that fear. We know that it's dangerous to die. And the only people who really want to die, I mean, of course there's so many odd people and unique people in the world, but it's a general rule, the only people who want to die is that their life is so unhappy that they want to die. What a qualification that is. Otherwise no one wants to die. And yet, we've died and died and died and died and died. So, what do you think? That fear is very deep. So it's not a simple thing to eradicate fear. It's not like we say, okay, I'm going to go on a fear-eradicating diet and I'm going to get rid of this. I'm going to really wipe this out for good. It's not like that. But to the degree that we learn about Krishna, we hear about Krishna, we seek Krishna's protection consciously, to that degree our fear will go down like a scale. So when we do our devotional activities, we sometimes do them mechanically. I speak for myself. And I finish my rounds. And I put my beads over here. And that's good. Now I can get on with my day. But we're asked by those who are wise not to do our devotional activities mechanically, but to try to have some sense that actually I'm trying to develop my love for Krishna. That's why I'm doing this. I'm trying to do this for this reason. And really, honestly, if you get that, we've all had moments where you completely eradicate fear because you feel so buoyant and safe in your Krishna consciousness. So we need more of that, basically. And the process is there, the practice is there. And we're going to hear in the next, tomorrow morning, Lord Balaram is going to come in. And he's going to assess the whole situation and give his advice. And he will speak some very wise words to help us with this dilemma. Any more? Yes, Mataji.
When we are I'm new to this Krishna consciousness and all that stuff. When I'm walking, I mean, I'm in a walking state only. So shall I make sure that my family members and all are also following that? Or
no. No, first of all, make yourself strong. You know, when you go on an airplane, you've been on an airplane recently, and you know, also you get this little card and it tells you what to do when there's a difficulty, and they always tell you that you put your oxygen mask on first, and then you put it on your child. Because otherwise, while you're trying to make them strong, and you're not strong, they may make you weak. So first you become strong. And sometimes it's wise to stand up and be very forceful, and sometimes it's wise to be very quiet and discreet. And so that kind of guidance you need from those who are encouraging you along your beginning path in Krishna consciousness. You know, what's the best way to approach the situation? And you take good guidance, and gradually things will improve. Any more? Yes. Yeah. Okay, next.
Rukmini, she has taken the reins and then she was driving the chariot. It is said that the soldiers did not attack Krishna because they have seen their own princess was driving the chariot.
Interesting.
So, what is that lesson we learn from that?
You'll have to leave that one with me. I'll talk about it tomorrow. That's something to think about. Thank you. We will speak about that tomorrow. Yes.
Continuing the purpose, how to overcome fear. This is what I have observed, because many a time I feel anxiety. Then I chant, and when I'm chanting, two things are happening simultaneously. One, I'm making an attempt to hear the holy name. And at the same time, I'm excluding my negative thoughts. So therefore, one is the positive aspect of getting attached to Krishna. And at the same time, I'm reinforcing by being away from my negative thoughts. Therefore, the fear or the anxiety component drops down.
Very practical. And if by chance, as it sometimes happens, you can't get away from the negative thoughts, then at least you keep the negative thoughts over there. Even though they keep coming back, you keep pushing them over there. Because sometimes you have the control over them, and sometimes they control you. But yes, by chanting, you're doing two things at once. Reducing the negative and increasing the positive. One more question at the back. Yes.
Won't be able to articulate it very well, Mataji, but okay. Pertaining to like a lotus flower within the water.
Yes.
So you're not impacted with all this distress and misery. But when you can see the material world, all the activities are actually meaningless. You can literally see you're working in a share market. Or you invented something, great, but at the same time that same invention has created the problem.
Yeah.
So, you can see the both sides, and you can feel material activities in fact are creating miseries. So then, sort of next to useless.
Next to useless. And sometimes worse than useless.
They are, once you have got rid of, the attachment which we have, you can literally see all the activities you're performing in the material.
And then what do you do?
So basically, my question is then, you're trying to get attached to the real, which is Krishna, right? But is there such a balance between material and spiritual, you can have that balance, materially and spiritually. Is there such a thing? We say, we have the material balance and we've got the spiritual balance.
Do you know what my answer to that is? There is a balance, but we're so heavily weighed and attracted to the material that you might as well put all your attention on the spiritual, and you might get into balance. We're so attracted to the material, isn't it? To the computer, to the television, to the mobile phone, to the latest camera, to the latest sound, to the latest... This is all the senses. This is material. The ears, the tongue, the eyes, the nose, the... You know, everything outward, it's so magnetically attractive for us. So we already have that. Attraction or repulsion is the same. Attraction is attraction, and repulsion is attraction. So I'm weak on the other side. Always, I find, in any situation, I have to increase the spiritual quotient to actually get into balance. Because sometimes I think, oh, I've been chanting and doing this, I need a little more material. But it's not like that, because that comes spontaneously. And this comes with work. It comes with use, proper use of one's intelligence. You'll be going against the grain of the whole material world when you try to cultivate this. So how difficult is that? So much easier to go with the flow. Srila Prabhupada's answer to that was that you must do daily sadhana of some sort. If you can come to the temple, there's one sadhana schedule. If you cannot come to the temple, if you live far away, you must set up some worship in your home that you're committed to, and you have to do it. There's a discipline in doing that. Because then what happens is, some of the time, even though your mind is even not there, you have to do something for Krishna. The rest of the time, yes, you're taken by the flow because all these things are going on. But sometimes you have to stop that flow and do something that nourishes your strength to remember Krishna. That's one side. And another side that I sometimes think about, and I can't say I have any realization about, but I reflect on it, is that if I'm thinking that everything belongs to Krishna, then even these things that are attracting me or drawing all my attention, that's also Krishna. It's Krishna's and it's Krishna. So I need to see like that. I'm doing this, whatever I'm doing is supposed to be for Krishna's pleasure. These elements belong to Krishna. These people belong to Krishna. And I can't see it, but I hear it, if you understand. And that's the beginning of seeing it. And then you have to work. Just like you have to work at work, you have to work at this. You have to. Otherwise, you're right, it won't grow. It'll just be a little something there. And then you've observed that this is all wasting time. You haven't done anything with this. At the time of death, how you lament. I spent my whole life looking at the useless. And the reality. And there are bhajans like that, by great personalities who express this sentiment. Narottam Das Thakur, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they sing songs about this, their prayers. So we can identify with their sentiments where they say, I've wasted my whole life. Having not worshipped Radha Balava, I have knowingly drunk poison. So there are personalities who empathize with us and want us to align ourselves with their understanding instead of going with the whole materialistic way of thinking. So some time has to be put to that, or else where will we go? So there's no excuse for nothing. We have to do something. Even if we're living in the temple, we have to do that. You may think, I'm living in the temple, so I'm kind of safe. But we're not. Because we have to be 100 times better example than somebody who's not living in the temple. If we're not 100 times better example, what are we? One time I was in India, I went to a temple. And when I visited the temple, I noted that there wasn't very many people at the Mangalarti. And then I noticed that there was a chokidar at the door. And the chokidar at the door had a list of all the people who lived in the temple. And the chowkidar, who's a paid man, he's paid by the temple, he was ticking off the names of people who attended Mangalati, and those people could have breakfast. And the others couldn't. And I thought, what a sad situation when your paid servant has to keep check on the master to see if the master is doing what he's supposed to do. And then I went from that particular place. I had to do something it was in India, and I had to do something. And I went out of the temple, and I went to the railway station. And it was unbelievable. Now, of course, all the people who live in these crowded metropolises, they know what a train in India is like. But I'd never seen anything like it. I was standing there, the train came, it was totally full, and I had to get in there as well. And they pushed me in there, and they pushed me and pushed me till I was away in the back. When it was time to get out, I was trying to get out, and I couldn't get out. And I was thinking, I'm a devotee, I can't beat all these people to get out. And I went past my stop, one stop, two stops. And then somebody said to me, excuse me, if you don't push, you're never going to get off this train. And I pushed my way out, and I was like, oh, that was horrible. And I was thinking, you see, they're going like that, and we're in bed. They have to work so hard. We don't have to do that. We see the stupid materialists. They're just wasting their lives doing, working like dogs. And we, well, you know, So in that one moment, I saw that if you live in the temple, you've got your own set of pressures. You've got your own set of responsibilities. You have to shoulder that too. You have to seek to maintain that. That's your contract with Krishna. And if you're not living in the temple, then you have to do your hard work in the material world. And it's not that one's better, actually. In one sense, one is better, obviously, because you're surrounded by Krishna consciousness more. But it depends on the performance of the individual which one is better. Because you can become very humble working out in the world, right? Anyone has noticed? You become very humble. By the end of the day, you're exhausted and you come home and you think, what am I doing with my life? Some people feel like that. Of course, other people like it out there. They love that work. Then they should be taught, okay, so give something to Krishna. You'd like to work like that? No problem. Work like that. You have a temperament to work like that. But give some of the fruits to Krishna. So whether we like it, we don't like it, there's a process for us. And Bhagavad Gita outlines that process, and we have to follow it if we want to make spiritual advancement and keep things in balance. Is that okay? You have more that you want to? Okay. All right. If there are any more, if not, we will stop here. Any more?